Hey, thanks for dropping by. Come on in.
Time to retire to the drawing room.
It is the drawing room. You're on RN Drive, and that means you're on Radio National, but you could also be listening to it on a digital device, including on the world wide world of web, where things like radio shows, but increasingly TV shows and things, are happening. And this is partly what I want to talk about today in the drawing room. We're going all over the place. The dusty red soil of the Pilbara, the lush green surrounds of the Hunter Valley wine region. We're doing it all in the drawing room because we can do it all online these days. A couple of guys are joining me whose voices and faces you may have seen, whose names you may not recognise immediately. Steve Briggs, you've heard many times. He's one of the country's leading voiceover artists, but he's more than that. He's a filmmaker and he's the author of a memoir as well, which has recently been released, which is, I think, delightfully called The Boy Who Could Tickle Clouds. Fantastic title. You don't need to know any more about it. That's pretty much enough. And he joins us in the drawing room along with a man who's responsible for some of TV's most controversial antics, including the, you remember the chaser when they did that Apex security stunt? Yeah, that was his fault. He did that. Nathan Earle is his name. He's a TV producer and a director, and he's got a new project about the wine industry, which is an internet sensation. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
This migration to online is interesting. Is this what you do when you can't find a place in traditional media? I say on my radio program.
You look out.
Yes.
No, I just think it's where the audience is going. I think content is content, whether it's delivered by the internet or television or radio. And in the end of the day, people are seeking out good content. I think it's becoming less and less important how it's delivered. People just want what they want when they want, and they want the ability to choose and watch it whenever they can.
It's more than that, though. One of the things that's most interesting about your bio, Nathan, is the sheer range of experience, but also the doors that still were closed when that was the case, which kind of meant that online became the thing no one could stop you doing.
Well, indeed, that's right. I think it's challenging being a producer and a director in television in Australia because your face isn't necessarily out there all the time. And I think there is a perception in some circles of television that if you're not on camera, then you have no creative avenues available to you.
Actually, it's the opposite, isn't it?
Oh, well, it is.
I think it's people on camera who don't have the creative outlet.
Exactly. It's ridiculous. There'd be nothing without us, nothing. And you know, I think you look at the rise of great cable television in the US and UK and people like David Simon and all those guys. I mean, they are showrunners within their own right, and those programs would not exist without them. And I think there is a tendency to think that if you're not a face that appears on a panel show talking about pop culture, you have no creative opportunities, I guess, to put your voice out there and create a show unto yourself.
And that is the beauty of the online sort of world, I think, because you can, if someone decides somewhere that, no, it's not going to happen, you can just go, well, hey, let's put it out there and see. And then suddenly you've got a lot of people enjoying what you're doing or subscribing to you or whatever it is. And then suddenly it's like, well, no, actually it does. It has merit because people are clearly connecting with it. And I self-published this memoir, and I'm now in a position where I'm talking to publishers about doing it the legitimate way because it's...
Interesting word to use.
Well, it's hilarious because I am literally an illegitimate child because I'm adopted and I'm a bastard. I was born out of wedlock. And here I am now...
You really left nothing else for us to throw at you.
Let's just get it out there early. It's the George Michael defense.
He is a bastard. I was talking to him earlier.
But by doing, I've completely lost. I'm stuck in Freedom 90 for a second.
You use the word legitimate.
Yeah, well,
I find that really interesting that even then, here you are preaching the virtues of self-publishing and online and so on, but you still...
There's still a...
The Freudian slip was there. There is this distinction between what is legitimate, that is, it has a big label brand on it, and that which doesn't. And it seems that we still have that.
As I am an illegitimate child in search of legitimacy, it is bizarre. I've been to a couple of writers' festivals and been at a table with some very sort of heavy hitters, and I was cracking lots of gags and we're all having fun. And then someone said, "So what do you actually do?" And I said, "Oh, I do a few things, but I've written a book." And oh, really? And I said, "Look, let's just get the dirty linen on the table. I've self-published." And honestly, this lady's face, you may as well have said I've done 10 years for fiddling with otters. I mean, it was just too much.
That was too long. You didn't deserve that.
That otter was consenting. Yeah. I will take that to my grave.
In your book. I didn't realise that was an otter incident.
That got edited out of the memoir. It may have been self-published. It wasn't that self-published. Someone got in the way.
But there is a perception, and I mean, I'm maybe it's my age, but I still think, recently my book went into readings and I saw it on the shelf because it's always been online, and I got a little bit teary seeing my book on the shelf.
Old-fashioned like.
Yeah, it was just like, it's suddenly, it's real. It's there it is. You can't deny it. Whereas online is great, and you go, oh, I'm number 4 on the human bestsellers list. But it's not tangible to some degree.
I do agree. I think there is a certain stigma about online that still exists. I know when I told people I was making Plonk as a web series.
Right? We should say what Plonk is.
Plonk is it's a satirical look at wine programming and wine shows. It's a look behind the scenes of the making of a wine show. It's very isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's hilarious. I watched 3 episodes this morning.
It's genius.
It's
so good. Oh, congratulations. I can see why it's cult, but is it only online because you couldn't get it onto telly?
A little bit, but it's also, I felt that in terms of format, it just gives us so much more flexibility and freedom. We had no editorial constraints on it whatsoever from our sponsors. It's the length we want to make it. We distribute it when we want and how we want. We retain all the intellectual copyright and the property on it. I mean, we were online 3.5 weeks after we finished shooting it. We weren't waiting for a time slot or a marketing campaign to kick in. And if the show doesn't rate, it's not going to get moved to a graveyard shift and they're not going to talk about what we're going to go up against. And so part of it is there are fewer and fewer opportunities for creatives to get their programming made, both on commercial, you know, and the ABC. But it also gives us a greater flexibility to put every joke we want out there and control not only the distribution model, but the financing model as well.
But let's be honest, does that total creative freedom to put every joke that you want in there, does it make a better product? Or do sometimes you need the discipline of a network who's going to step in and say, this is a waste of time, this is too much, this is too long?
But yeah, I certainly take your point. But I think if you've built a great group of creative people around you,
it's
that feedback
team,
is there.
It?
I don't think you need an executive producer who's not necessarily across any of the material telling you what they think is funny or not. And I think if, you know, I've got a fantastic cast around me, a fantastic editor, a fantastic cinematographer and a co-producer, and I think they're my sounding board. I trust their judgment comedically, from a storytelling perspective, from an acting perspective. You know, whether I'm too hammy.
Yeah. Right.
The case, you know, and they've got a great deal of experience across a wide range of genres of television. I think they're your sounding board. I think if you build a collective team of creatives around you, you don't necessarily need layers and layers of hierarchy telling you what they think will and won't work.
Stephen, what about your book? Every book needs a really good editor at some point, doesn't
it? Yeah. My wife was the editor of my book. God bless her.
And you're still together. Congratulations.
I know. Isn't that extraordinary? There were long periods where not much was said. I must be honest. But no, my book, do you know, I wrote it and then I sent it to some publishers and I got 4 rejections. And then it sat in my top drawer for 12 years. And 12 years. And my wife kept saying, you've got to do something with that book. Because when I pulled it out of the drawer and I started reading through it, I was laughing so much because I honestly didn't know what was happening in the next line, let alone the next page.
Yeah, right.
Because I hadn't looked at it for so
long. So you're like your own editor in a way because you had that distance.
In a way. But my wife's incredibly well-read and she's the most wonderful person. And she, you know, offered her suggestions and I've changed a few things. A lot of it, though, is pretty much as it came out, because it's very heartfelt. My dad died, and rather than deal with his death, I wrote him, essentially. I thought if I write him well enough, then he won't be dead. He'll still be with me.
That's a very powerful response, to deal with it in that sort of way. And then the publication element of it, the getting the major publisher involved, almost becomes secondary.
Well, I must say, about 3 times a week I'll get an email from someone. They'll say very nice things about the book and about how much my father touched them and how moved they were by the book. And also, they laughed a lot.
Yes.
It's a very funny book. Well, I shouldn't say that. But, you know, it's short of getting married and having 2 beautiful boys. That's, you know, the first time I got one of those, it was such an incredibly affirming experience because, you know, I couldn't help but think I might have done all right for you, Dad, you know.
Yeah.
And was it also cathartic just getting it out of your system, living with an idea, living with this book, this manuscript, just the idea of getting it published and being done with it in some ways?
Yeah, Nathan, it was the first 3/4 of the book actually came quite easily, and it was a lot of funny stories and stuff that's happened to me along, and I've had a very bizarre life, but, you know, in a good way. And so
it's good for a memoir.
It is good for a memoir. And then when I got toward the end, I just couldn't write it, and I kept thinking, what am I doing? And then one day I went, oh, my God, I have to kill him off, and you don't want to, and you're putting a block So I used to get up at 4 in the morning and for a couple of hours just bang it out before I had a chance to even sort of power up.
No filter.
No filter, yep. Exactly. Whatever those frontal lobes or whatever it is, didn't get a chance, and I just got it out. It took me an Easter to write Dad's Death, and I bawled for the whole time.
But that's probably why it works. That's probably why the book is successful. It's probably why you are now getting approaches from major publishers, because they've seen the work and it came from somewhere real. And I wonder if that is a difference with stuff that does end up online as opposed to going through sort of the major industry machine. Is it stuff that is made because it needs to be made by whoever's making it rather than fulfilling any other imperative?
Yeah, I'd agree with that, definitely. I think, for something like Plonk, it was just an idea I had bubbling away, since film school, 5 or 6 years ago. And it was I got to a point in my career where I felt, look, no one's going to give me the opportunity to make this, no matter how many shows I write or produce or direct. So the only way to prove that I can do it is to do it and move heaven and earth to get it done. So from that perspective, it's not necessarily about career advancement or financial advancement. It's just something that's inside of you that needs to get out so you can finally, live in peace.
Would you say the imperatives are different? Did you feel there were different imperatives at work when you were making this as opposed to the stuff that you have done on TV?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was a much more personal imperative. I felt that Plonk, in a weird way, was proving not only to myself but to others that I was capable of doing what I could do, which is to create and show, run and direct and write and produce a program of quality equal to anything you'll see on broadcast television. And I think, for the most part, Plonk succeeds there. That was certainly my number one driving force.
Well,
to prove it.
Drinking a lot of wine was perhaps...
There was that too. Yeah. The Chardonnay trail didn't help. Yeah, there was that as well.
We're down number three now. Good. Okay.
top five
it's
reasons.
Definitely one of the reasons.
We've got the food, we've got the wine, we've got the travel. Yeah.
Then it's after that. You're in the drawing room. That's the voice of Nathan Earle. He's the producer and director of Plonk, which is do we call it a webisodes? Is that the appropriate
web
thing?
Series?
But it's ended up on TV now.
It has now,
it's been picked up.
Yeah, it's on Channel 11. So we cut the five webisodes into 3 half-hours, and Channel 11 and Channel 10 are playing it, and it's on Qantas domestic flights as well. So
there you go.
Saw it on the way down, which is quite embarrassing.
Actually perfect for a Qantas flight.
Now they've got nowhere to go.
But, wine and on travel and all that sort of thing. It's perfect for it. Stephen Briggs is my other guest in the drawing room. He's the author of a book called The Boy Who Could Tickle Clouds, but he's also a filmmaker, and a lot of your films you put online.
Yes, I was mentioning to Nathan earlier, I have made one film that's almost had 200,000 hits on YouTube now, but it is a little bit racy, and I was saying, do you reckon I can mention that? It's every man's worst nightmare.
Yes.
It's getting caught masturbating. Now, yes. I've said it. It's good. Out there. It's out there. So, and I'd love to say it was fiction.
I'm sorry, I didn't realise you were in there.
I didn't read that bit in The Boy Who Could Tickle Clouds.
No, this is certainly after The Boy Who Could Tickle Clouds. But yes, it's been an interesting experience, because that gets 200 or 300 hits a day now, that film, and that's slowly growing. It also has the amazing Damien Walsh Howling in the lead, who is such a brilliant actor.
Well, this is what's amazing about this. The people that actually will, the actors, the performers who will sign up for this sort of stuff, presumably you don't have huge budgets to throw at them.
I had virtually no. I was at VCA Film School, and it was my first little film. We were shooting on this terrible Ikigami SP, awful. But he thought it was funny, and I storyboarded around what was going to go on with the bust, and it's a long, I won't tell it, it's a long story, but it's very funny, because my girlfriend at the time was a TV reporter, and there was the court reporter from Channel 10, Channel 9, SBS, The Australian and The Sydney Morning Herald that all came in. I'll cut to the end. And then I hit stop on the racy material that I was watching, and it reverted back to the television, and there was a granny. And, in fact, there were 100 grannies in white suits line dancing. And it looked, for all intents and purposes, like
it's
I
an
was...
odd fetish, isn't it?
Was, that was what got
perfectly
me...
natural response.
Got me through the night.
But I think I just think good actors want to act in good material. I mean, we were lucky enough to get Steve Bisley and Susie Porter and cameos from Matt Moran and Stuart McGill who just liked the idea and wanted
to be part of
it.
And Plonk, of course, involves Chris Taylor.
Oh, Chris Taylor, absolutely.
But I mean, you have a long-standing relationship with The Chaser, which
helps.
Yeah,
I do. Blackmail helped there.
Yeah.
Blackmail Chris into being the host of Plonk. But and I think they're not making the demarcation between web and television.
But they make the demarcation between money and not?
They do, but I'm increasingly finding if they do genuinely like the material and they enjoy the experience, the money becomes less important.
That's a good development.
Less support. You know, my co-producer got a lovely email from Steve Bisley after he'd come and shot with us for a night, saying it was a wonderful experience, and same with Susie. I think they just enjoyed the small collaborative yep. process of us all just hanging out in Mudgee, you know, yeah. making a wine show, drinking. A show about a wine show.
Yes, yeah, that's right. It's going back to what got you into it in the first place, isn't it? I mean, that's kind of what it's about, for the people on camera, for the people off camera, for everyone involved.
Yeah, I think so. I think we all get into this business because of the joy collaboration brings. And I think sometimes the bigger the show and the bigger the budget, the less collaboration occurs. And,
yeah. So to anyone who's really, really successful, all you need to say is you look at them and you go, they are clearly miserable.
That's what I thought.
Horrible life. I know. Who'd want it?
I don't even own a couch, and I'm extremely happy.
Exactly. George Clooney, who'd want to be him? Now, Stephen, if you're listening to The Drawing Room and you're listening to Stephen and you're wondering where you've heard his voice before, the answer is probably everywhere. I'm a bit intimidated having you in here, Stephen, because one of the strings to your bow is that you are a voiceover artist.
Yes, I am. Yes,
you said you worked in advertising, and so you're very au fait with all of this. I've listened to some of your work. It is extraordinary, of course, which is why you get this work. But there is one that caught my eye, and I can't help but think that something advertising this program could sound a little bit like this if we had a bit of imagination. So let's take a listen.
Sure.
And then you can tell me whether or not you think it would be on brand for RN Drive or The Drawing Room or something like that. Radio National generally.
Sure.
Okay?
Sure.
All right, let's have a listen.
Nicki Minaj returns to Australia reloaded. Now in her amazing full arena show. Rod Laver Arena, October 6. Nicki Minaj, tickets on sale August 3.
I want to go to that now.
How did you get so high?
It doesn't sound anything like you.
No, I know. That's in my business, you know, there's so much mystery. So much there isn't. There's two speeds. There's either this guy that kind of talks like this, or there's this guy that talks like that. And there's no in between. And that's pretty much, you know, for years I was the So Fresh guy that used to do those.
Really?
So fresh. And then, you know, around 38, something dropped and I just said, I just can't do this.
38, really?
Yeah, maybe 39.
Oh, wow.
I must say, if you do like those Nicki Minaj ones or So Fresh, you do need to lie down after. You can't fake it. The only way you can make it sound like it's the most incredible thing in the world is to believe it with your entire essence. And that's very tiring.
You're really devoting your essence to something that's...
Well, look, I call it whoring the chords. I'm giving so many trade secrets away.
Nothing that you would do that for would end up going straight to online, would it?
No.
Can you do one for us?
Yeah, of course.
So what would an RN Drive promo or a Drawing Room promo, whatever you want, it sounds like a Nicki Minaj tour promo. What would that sound like? I want it to sound like we're playing Rod Laver Arena. That's what I want it to sound like.
Okay.
It's the most intelligent thing on radio. It's Waleed Ali's The Drawing Room. Get it now.
I love it. It's great.
Usually they're kind of short too.
Yeah,
so
I know.
If you do that, then...
Well, you've probably given us like $300,000 worth of voiceover there. That's the going rate, isn't it?
I've just done something. No.
Well, is that a health hazard?
There are days where you scream a lot. And if I have a really pedantic client and I'm screaming, I'll always be polite. It's a business where you're only as good as your last gig. But I will say, look, you know, I am redlining now. And if I go any further, my larynx may be on the left turn. So
what's the weirdest thing you've ever voiceovered?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, Nathan.
Are you casting here? Have you got something in mind?
I was once the voice of a thing called The Man Line, pre-internet, which was this gay introduction service.
Yeah.
I recognised it.
And I used to say, hi, you've called The Man Line. Gym jock or bodybuilder, press 1. Leather or rubber fetish, press 2. Guys are into guys in uniform, press 3. And it was...
I don't know about you, but I'm hot.
Let's go.
It was a very interesting gig. I think we recorded like 1,000 paragraphs for The Man Line. It was like a week and a half job.
Right.
Like 8. And
it's like City Rail. There's that many options.
Really.
I know.
There were a lot of options, let me tell you.
There's your next TV project.
I'm writing it down as we speak.
Yeah, a show about for doing voiceovers for The Man Line. That's not what Plonk is. Plonk is looking at making a show about wine. If you've ever watched one of those lifestyle sort of shows that tends to go to air on the weekend when no one's watching, it's that kind of show
exactly.
You're talking about.
That's what we're aspiring to.
Yeah, but it's one of the best send-ups of that you will ever find. It's called Plonk. It's on online, but as you've heard, it's made its way to Channel 11 and Channel 10, which means it is therefore legitimate. Not like The Boy Who Could Tickle Clouds, which is Stephen Briggs' self-published memoir, which is so legitimate, though, I have to say, that it's now in bookstores as well as online. Gentlemen, it's been a joy. I'd love to keep going with this, but sadly I can't. Thank you so much.
Waleed, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. That's it for The Drawing Room. Back at 6 o'clock tomorrow. Until then, intelligent!